Good afternoon and welcome to our fourth and final session in today's web conference, The Speed of Change. The slide on your screen shows the collaborating institutions and individuals that have put this program together. My name is Ramiro Lobo. I'm a Small Farms and Agricultural Economics Advisor with the University of California located in San Diego County, and I will be the moderator for this session. Ag in Uncertain Times is a webinar series that is intending to help producers and others meet the challenges of today's uncertain economy and also to keep up with the fast pace of change. Our session this afternoon, Session D, will focus on specialty, niche, and food safety issues, and we'll provide an overview of food safety issues, including technical aspects of contamination and disease outbreaks and their economic implications for domestic and international markets. Our speakers today are Dr. Trevor Soslow, an extension research specialist with the Department of Vegetable Crops and Center for Product Safety with the University of California, Davis, and Dr. Marco Palma, assistant professor and extension economist with the Agricultural Economics Department at Texas A&M University. I will tell you more about the speakers today when we formally introduce them at the start of their presentations. Before we get going, we would like to update you on some of the ways that you can interact with the speakers and in this session, and you can use the question and answer Q&A window to ask questions for the speakers today. You click inside the box on your left, and then you type your question, and once you're done typing, please click on this button to send the question to the presenters. These questions will be asked for each speaker at the end of their session, and also we will come back at the end of the session to in a panel format to for a panel Q&A. The Ag in Uncertain Times also has a companion website where we have linked to past webinars. The URL that appears on your screen will provide you access to audio recording, PowerPoint slides, and even video files of the presentations that you can use as you please to so that you can disseminate the materials and information presented to your local audiences in whichever format you choose to use. The full screen button at the top of at the right top corner of your screen allows you to toggle between full screen, and this allows you to see the entire screen, or you can view the presentation and the chat window and the chat Q&A window at the same time. We recommend you try it to get familiar and find the format that best fits your viewing style. Now we would like to get some feedback from you as participants to let us know and respond to the questions that are going to show on your screen. We would like for you to tell us where you are located. First, what is your primary occupation? Are you a producer, an educator? Are you with the banking industry, agribusiness professional? Please let us know so that we can tailor this to better suit your needs. Thank you, and we'll move to the next question. We would also like to know where in the U.S. you are located, where your business is located, whether it is in Northeast, Southeast, Midwest, Southwest, and again, this helps us find out what issues and information needs there are across the U.S. so that we can program webinars and meet those needs. Thanks. We'll move on to the next question, please. Including yourself, to get a sense of how many people are attending or participating in this live broadcast, we would like to know, are you watching this by yourself, or is there anywhere from 2 to 5 people with you, or 6 to 10? Please answer the choice that best represents your situation. Thank you. Thank you for your feedback. I would like to welcome Dr. Trevor Soslow, who is an extension research specialist at the University of California, Davis, with the Department of Plant Sciences. Trevor has statewide responsibilities in post-harvest quality and safety of perishable fresh and fresh-caught horticultural foods. His program emphasizes the role of the environment and crop production practices on post-harvest attributes of edible horticultural crops. And for the past 16 years, Trevor has combined lab and on-farm research related primarily focusing on E. coli and Salmonella in both conventional and organic production systems. Trevor is a member of the Center for Produce Safety Advisory Board and Technical Advisory Board, and also leads the University of California GAPS Outreach Program. So with that, Trevor, today Trevor is going to give us an overview of fresh produce supply chain food safety management. And with that, Trevor, please welcome and thanks for thank you for joining us today.
Okay, thank you, Ramiro, and good afternoon to everyone. Just want to make sure that everyone's aware I designed this presentation, you know, really as an entry-level overview of produce food safety-related issues and moving from general guidance to a regulated community as the proposed FDA produce safety rule comes out. I'll touch on each of those, and that will hopefully give you a good background for the second speaker that will talk a bit more depth about the economic impact of the different programs as well as outbreak and illness. And again, I see that some of our participants are very knowledgeable about these sort of general aspects, and maybe with your specific questions, you know, it can deal with some of the more specific uncertainties or technical components. And so really, you know, what has been true from the beginning of recognizing the role of predominantly microbial issues and hazards associated with production of our edible horticultural products, that food safety really has to function across the entire farm-to-fork continuum or the farm-to-fork supply chain, and at each component as depicted sort of pictorial in this slide, you know, from, in this case, strawberry production in an open field environment, all of the inputs that go in there, the adjacent land use, wildlife influences, which we'll come back to, through harvesting, you know, post-harvest handling, transportation and distribution, and finally either food service or retail marketing and consumption by the end user. You know, there are unfortunately opportunities for contamination, but then likewise there are opportunities for preventive controls and interventions along the entire continuum. So just to establish for those that aren't perhaps as aware as those that have been, you know, thrust into this arena, you know, why the concern for food safety of edible horticultural products, I'm going to cover a bit of an overview of foodborne illness in the U.S. Clearly there's international incidents, some of very tragic proportions. There just isn't time to cover all of the details in each of these aspects. Then a bit of an introduction to good agricultural practices and the associated produce outbreaks as sort of a background for then the further discussion of the economic impact and responses. A very brief introduction to what is going on currently in the FDA Produce Safety Rule, Food Safety Modernization Act, regulations that are coming out for public comment. Some of the key on-farm challenges that the industry, you know, has identified, research is trying to close the knowledge gap in how to deal with those contamination events. And then, very briefly, just one example from our on-farm research effort to sort of highlight, you know, what we're worried about, how we're approaching it, and how that may likely influence some of the standards and policies that are being established both within industry as well as from a public health agency standpoint. So very, again, briefly, just to set the stage, the Center for Disease Control, you know, estimates this foodborne illness to be close to 9.5 million cases per year. That's not just for fresh produce. That covers all foodborne illness events, and tragically, you know, as perhaps as many as 1,200 deaths per year, which translates to about 1 in 6 individuals in the U.S. becoming ill every year. Most of these cases are fairly mild. They clear in a short period of time, but as I'm sure you're all aware, some are extremely severe with follow-on consequences for chronic long-term health impacts, and of course, potentially death can result. The sort of key taking a step back food safety challenges are broader than just the microbial ones that we will highlight through the rest of this presentation. They include chemical, physical hazards, and of course then the biological, which can be further separated into microbial, various allergens and various toxins that would be elaborated due to the growth of microorganisms, or they might be actually part of the some chemical compound produced by the plant. The category of mycotoxins, or toxins produced by fungi that colonize plant material, kind of fit into the chemical hazard area as opposed to the biological. The organism doesn't need to be present. Not commonly associated with fresh produce, but there is that potential. Chemical hazards, just again to provide a bit of the overview, includes a variety of things that are involved in crop production inputs or post-harvest management. They may be associated with the equipment, fertilization, of course, pest management. Various foods, you know, may have allergens if it's part of a more processed or prepared food. And then just, again, listing the types of mycotoxins for those that might be familiar in other types of foods, particularly some of the grains. Aflatoxin, peanuts would be another. Ochratoxin can be present in a variety of things. And patulin is one that would be more associated with something like apple juices or ciders. Again, just trying to give a bit of a background. Most of these toxins are produced by fungi such as Aspergillus, Penicillium, and Fusarium. And a lot of these toxins, they can have acute impacts, including in animal feed, but in general they tend to be more of a long-term chronic concern due to their cancer potential. Physical hazards we deal with in the produce area primarily as a consequence of things that are in the field that may either be in the adjacent land or within the crop production environment that include the things that are easy to imagine, you know, glass, wood shards, either from, you know, say a pallet or a bin, or it may come from the non-crop plants in the general area, of course, stones and plastics and metal, and unfortunately, occasionally, you know, animals, whole or animal parts, may or may not be a physical hazard in terms of ingestion, but certainly an aversion factor if they're found in the product. And therefore, you know, I'm sort of briskly moving through these components to get to the microbial concerns, but this is all part of an overall food safety management program. Prevention of physical hazards and mitigation can include, you know, prior crop history, and the image on the left is simply meant to illustrate the potential for prior crop residue that is very woody and hard and doesn't decay or break down within the season can be picked up during harvest and enter into the particularly a bag salad type packaging. There may be things left over from other prior crop rotations that could be banding or strapping or various types of items. And this is primarily a larger concern in any type of mechanized harvesting as depicted here, where a large unit is moving down a solid planted bed. A little bit hard to inspect and visualize some of the potential physical hazards that might be present. They do put people out in front of these machines now to walk and try and minimize that potential, but you can imagine as they're harvesting, these might be picked up and incorporated into the bulk product that's harvested, and then there's various ways that this is dealt with at the product handling and processing end, whether it's passing through a metal detection, various laser and X-ray detection and elimination systems, and some of the, you know, more modern chlorophyll-based defect removal where either a non-product plant material or a plant material that has a lesion or some type of defect would be quickly removed by an air jet. I see that some of the formatting, you know, clips off a little bit of the content here, but I think it's still readable and understandable, so I do apologize for that. Just sort of an interesting thing for those that aren't aware, things like metallic fibers incorporated into bandages or finger bobs or other types of covering are used to readily detect them as they pass through metal detection equipment. It has that sensitivity, and that helps prevent a consumer from finding this in their purchases. So then moving on to the area of a bit broader concern, the microbial pathogens, it's estimated that there are about 250 foodborne pathogens. A much smaller subset of those are the ones that are predominantly encountered by public health agencies and involved in clinical cases. Bacteria are certainly the most widely encountered and recognized, but of course it includes viruses and various parasites, norovirus, or the virus that you might be familiar with, sort of the cruise ship type of illness, is thought to be responsible for many more cases of gastrointestinal illness than previously recognized, and currently a very substantial focus has been placed on that. So if we look at the various reported outbreaks linked to FDA-regulated foods, by agent, you can see that over about 70% are attributed to bacterial pathogens during this time period. This is sort of the most updated overview that was available from FDA. And if you look at food item, the reason meat is not on here, it's not part of FDA-regulated foods. But produce accounts for about 20% or so if you add in sprouts as a subcategory of overall produce. In terms of the number of cases as opposed to the percent of outbreaks, produce starts to take on a much greater significance in being closer to 40-something percent of the individuals impacted that actually go in and become part of the reported case history for any given outbreak. So it's been recognized over time, certainly since the early 90s, as an increasing contribution to the foodborne illness in the United States and globally. And if you look then a little bit further at the types of commodities associated with these outbreaks, it's a pretty extensive list. This includes both domestic and imported produce items. And pretty easy to see as you scan down that things such as leafy greens and lettuces, fresh tomatoes and melons, particularly cantaloupes, contribute, you know, close to 60% of the total number of outbreaks that have been recognized during this time frame. More recently, there are other tree nuts that have been included in causing outbreaks or significant recalls due to detection of these pathogens on product. And, of course, as I already mentioned, sprouts is sort of a category unto itself and unfortunately has a fairly high frequency of outbreak and large-scale illness quite often associated with their production. So all of this, again, going back sort of to the mid-90s, resulted in the development of this concept of good agricultural practices, recognizing that there is no absolute control point, no absolute kill step that is possible for those types of foods consumed raw or without a cooking step. And they really focused on prevention and redundant reductions or ways to minimize the risk as opposed to, in the absence of recognizing a step to truly eliminate it. At the time, this has not been regulation. It was guidelines only. But it kind of became the de facto minimal standard, and industry then embraced that and enhanced it and, you know, got more specific and quite often well ahead of where science could really substantiate the approaches and the standards that were being imposed. But, you know, the buyers became basically the enforcement branch, and that evolved into more commodity-specific and even region-specific guidance documents. And this is sort of just a representation of the diversity of programs that have been put together to try and refine the general guidance, of which there's a lot of commonality. This would be, you know, sort of bringing us into the mid-2000s, late 2000s, and the variety of commodity groups and associations put together guidance with various audit protocols associated with it. So coming up more or less to date then, this Food Safety Modernization Act was signed into law back in January 2011, and it really put the charge to FDA to move from responding to contamination events and following, tracking, and investigating outbreaks and illness to emphasizing preventing it and really to take the available best science to establish minimum standards for the safe production and the safe harvesting and post-harvest practices for fruits and vegetables that made sense, that really worked towards minimizing the risk. So the challenge then is to really focus on prevention and preventive controls across the entire food supply chain and, of course, all foods. Here today we're focused really on fresh produce. And it's going to be expected that there would be a written preventive control plan that includes the various steps listed, a hazard evaluation, the various steps or controls to minimize or prevent specific hazards associated with a site, with a practice, within an operation, to then monitor and verify that these preventive controls are functional, and where they're non-functional or become non-compliant, to specify appropriate corrective actions and verify that those corrective actions have been effective. So sort of the cycle of management that FDA has as far as its expectation is to really work within this preventive control strategy, and if there is a failure to identify that hazard, to sort of, I guess, devote some level of effort at understanding or identifying the root cause, and I'll be honest in saying that even with the outbreak investigations or the internal assessments that have been done, determining a root cause is not always straightforward or possible. But to implement corrective actions, to monitor the effectiveness of those controls, and then review and adjust your program and incorporate that into the body of your business plan. So, you know, we often talk about, a very well-established concept in risk management, which is sort of hurdle technologies, and this food safety really depends on preventive programs with multiple hurdles that start at pre-harvest and really pre-planting and carry forward all the way through post-harvest, that deal with barriers to arrival of contamination, the effects of acute survival, post-contamination, minimizing the chance for persistence or growth, at least of the bacterial pathogens, you know, clearly viral pathogens and parasites that require an animal host for growth are not going to multiply on plants. But pretty much every plant species that I'm aware that's been tested, if you apply something like salmonella, like E. coli, listeria, and there's appropriate environmental conditions, they will multiply. There's sufficient nutrients around. Then, of course, any steps in disinfection or removal, and then barriers to regrowth or persistence or growth in the distribution and transportation. So all of these good agricultural practice documents, the FDA produce safety rule, any type of harmonized good agricultural practice and good handling practice programs have some key areas that are felt to be appropriate for all scales of farming and shipping, so large global to limited resource, and these are primarily the focus that industry has taken and certainly that FDA is putting a lot of emphasis on, and these are various uses of water pre-harvest or through post-harvest, the involvement of workers and their potential for contamination sort of hand to product, and so therefore their personal hygiene, emphasis on training, and appropriate facilities and management of those facilities is seen as a key area the potential for contamination due to the application of manures or incompletely composted animal-based manures or even green waste, and the process controls and application and various diverse applications of soil inputs and fertility management inputs that have a potential for carrying fecal contamination in. And, of course, associated with that is a very challenging area of wildlife impacts on crop production and contamination, whether it's intrusion into the field or actual fecal deposits, either in water or in the crop area itself or on equipment. Again, there's a lot of different components, not really time to be able to go through all of these in detail. Associated with all of this, of course, is record keeping and documentation of what's being done, of that preventive control plan, as well as the specific daily operational management of that, and an ability to trace product at a minimum, one step back, one step forward for all inputs, as well as the distribution and marketing of that product. So, you know, sort of summarizing, you know, where things stand today very succinctly, you know, I think there's going to be increasing expectations from FDA and consumer groups for the full supply chain in produce to demonstrate and document the effectiveness of this preventive control strategy and any corrective actions that are designed to fit into it. And it's really reasonable to assume that the greatest pressure is going to be on the supply side or the sort of production side of produce, both from buyers as well as regulators and public health agencies. And at least I would share with you all that it's my experience and my belief that aside from a relatively elite group of the industry, most producers, if you talk about numbers and talk about the United States and all the different commodities, really are ill prepared and lack the necessary scientific literacy to develop these preventive control systems and farm managed food safety management plans without significant support. That doesn't mean they're not capable. It just means you can't just throw them out there and expect them to come up with a plan that would satisfy the expectations. One thing that is sort of within the FDA experience base is that relatively small farms, you know, can be responsible for very large multi-state outbreaks. The particular example I'm sharing with you here is the Salmonella St. Paul outbreak back in 2008 that caused, you know, over 1,000 cases of recognized illness because of the complication of traceback and traceability that was associated, first thought to be associated with fresh tomatoes. Still may be the case at one point in time, but it transitioned to the recognition that the more culinary peppers, the jalapeno serrano peppers, were probably the primary vehicle distributed, produced in relatively small amounts, distributed widely in small amounts, but part of a component of ingredients that made a lot of people ill. And many things came from that outbreak investigation. But within that Food Safety Modernization Act and the Produce Safety Rule, there are exemptions, at least on the books for now, for very small farms that are predominantly selling directly to consumers or farmers market within a certain defined radius. You can sort of read that here. I won't go into the detail. But those exemptions for now are at least planned. The FDA has stated that they will hold until there's a reason to be concerned and remove them. And we've all always maintained, certainly, and tried to help provide education that direct marketers, you know, have some real responsibilities to their customers for food safety as well. And although everybody doesn't have to be, have as elaborate programs as a larger consolidator, you know, everybody should be doing something. And a situation like this that was at least determined to be responsible for a small cluster of illnesses due to E. coli 157-87, I think anyone could look at that slide and say that's probably not the best area to be producing a crop like mixed, you know, mini greens. And, you know, some corrective actions may not prevent the potential for contamination to occur. More recently, some local fresh-grown strawberries were also implicated in outbreak with E. coli 157, 14 ill, and unfortunately one death. And these were all sold at UPIC farm stands and farmers markets. And what complicated the investigation is that the individual operation consolidated strawberries from several farms for their marketing, and as the health agencies came back to that individual operation, they found that the deer droppings genetically matched the case isolates, and there was really high deer pressure in that area, and sort of how all of that happened became very instructive for how one might look at small farm operations. So just taking a step back again, looking broadly at my exposure and experience to outbreak and recall investigations in fresh produce over the last 16 years, I would argue that quite often there was a moment in time for someone to recognize the microbial hazard was present and to make a prevention or control point decision that, you know, could have averted or at least greatly reduced the public risk and consequences to the overall industry and to consumers. And it's really the ability to recognize the microbial hazards as they're developing is a knowledge base and a tool that we have to continually work on to provide support for in training to be able to do that. So very quickly, I want to just touch on a couple of key areas and then get to research example and then close out. Water is one of the main areas of focus for microbial food safety concern because wherever that comes in contact with fresh produce, its particular quality can really determine the potential for pathogen contamination and persistence on crop based on its particular characteristics, profile, and the degree of contact with the edible portion that may result. Again, many, many details here that are involved both in the research and the implementation and practice of food safety management. All I can do is sort of point out probably some of the obvious ones, the way pathogens find their way to either surface water or groundwater, but here focus primarily on surface water as sort of the key area for risk. And of each of the risk factors identified in this cartoon, have been associated with particular contamination events, product recall, or in fact outbreaks, whether it's high bird populations, livestock, runoff from compost facilities or stockpile manure, or even irrigation return water or tail water coming back into a common shared irrigation conveyance system, storm runoff from urban centers. All of these things can contribute to the pathogen load of surface water that may be used for irrigation. So, again, the sort of multiple risk factors require the identification and implementation of multiple preventive hurdles. I talked a little bit briefly about worker training, and this cuts across the entire spectrum from field crews to packing, harvesting, and processing. Again, a lot of studies looking at transfer coefficients and transfer rates and a lot more knowledge about what the potential is. The response has been for at least some of the larger companies. They have very extensive training materials, standard operating procedures, standard sanitary operating protocols and log sheets, et cetera, and very fat binders. And, some of the more advanced companies, again, just sort of sharing what kinds of things go on, provide a standardized training, issue certification cards, which allows, say, harvest crews to be recognized across different companies because they all have the same need. Compost and soil amendments, at least incompletely composted or non-composted manure stockpiled adjacent to fields are a particular concern. Again, in some schemes, they're prohibited from use. Others, they're allowed within certain time frames. If you're interested, there are a variety of resources to get at the particular standards that exist. And, of course, the concerns are either direct transfer or indirect contamination through other inputs such as water or movement of various vectors or vermin, rodents to birds, and then also the proximity to a field where, perhaps a non-composted manure is being while you're in the process of harvesting an adjacent field. Again, all of these things have been shown to be potential hazards of concern. As we move inside to the processing plant, again, not an opportunity to go through details, but just to share with the audience that there's a high potential for cross-contamination and therefore, of course, a high focus on maintaining water quality and a lot of improvements in both water quality management and processes for sort of internal company surveillance of water quality over the last 5 years in particular. I think if you're not familiar with what a fresh cut salad or bag salad plant looks like, it's, you know, highly mechanized, very industrial, and same sorts of good manufacturing practices apply as in any food processing plant, which is some other challenges. Sort of getting to the end of the supply chain, you know, there are recognized risks along the entire chain, but one area that I don't think has had as much emphasis as is needed is in cold chain management and control of temperature. Again, trying to implement these preventive controls for at least growth of bacteria. So then finally, just to close out very quickly, to share just one example of how we address some of the risk assessment, I selected one for the recent study done out in a commercial farm environment, but on it within an experimental field on the survival of human bacterial pathogens on soil crop residues, and then a replant, a very important area dealing with the disposition of a contaminated field, whether it's by flooding or some other event. So here, just to share with you, you know, some of the things that we see, which are pretty typical of researchers doing these kinds of studies. Here we're comparing an attenuated E. coli 157 with a selected surrogate E. coli from that same region, contaminated artificially onto a spinach crop and then subsequently incorporated into the soil as if it was going through a crop destruct phase. A pretty typical thing we see for a couple of years is a bit of a burst of growth and then a slow decline with a very long survival tail, and the generic E. coli, more environmentally fit than the available attenuated 0157, you know, can be detected at a quantitative level out beyond 100 days. And then a subsequent test, we, you know, eliminated the attenuated E. coli as not being quite as robust as the surrogates that we had developed. I won't go through all of the different treatments because the outcome, you can see, was pretty much the same, but that same sort of burst of growth on the crop residue and then a fairly long survival tail to the point where it got below the limit of quantitative detection, still detectable by enrichment, the same different treatment but with an attenuated salmonella, pretty much the same profile. Salmonella tend to be a bit better. And then after it was below the quantitative level of recovery but still could be found periodically within the soil by enrichment, planted a crop again, and as you can see here at two different stages of crop development, both early and then sort of at commercial crop maturity, we were getting, you know, anywhere from 25 to, you know, almost 70% recovery of the applied strains on that crop that was replanted. So again, what we're trying to do here is provide the data to help establish the standards policies that the industry would use. So then to wrap up finally here, in summary, I would say that hopefully if you weren't aware already, you know, you're now convinced that, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables, you know, have been associated with significant foodborne illness burden. But, you know, in reality, the illness to total servings per year is staggeringly small. I that our next speaker will address that to some degree. And a lot of the contamination events are either directly or indirectly related to human and animal fecal transfer, although that's not the only way. And that really prevention is our best tool in the toolbox throughout the supply chain and really the preferred approach. But we can't lose track of the fact that the benefit of consumption of produce, either fresh or further processed, including, you know, canned or other processing steps, really remains a very important consumer message for a healthy diet, and an awful lot still has to be done and remains to retain and earn a greater level of consumer trust, which has really been shaken by some recent events. So really thank you for your patience and attention, and Romero, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you, Trevor. Excellent information, and I hope our participants feel the same way I do. We have a few questions, and we have time for a couple of questions before we move on to Dr. Palma's presentation. Question one is, what is your sense of the level of future government control to handle some of the issues you are discussing?
Okay. Well, I guess I will attempt to answer it in this way. I mean, clearly we're moving towards the produce sector becoming part of the regulated community as opposed to operating more under at least federal-level guidance and state-level guidance. The ability to really control all aspects of the diverse scales of production, the diverse commodities, regions, and et cetera, is a very daunting task, and I'm not confident that there are enough, at least financial resources, to do that. So I think it really is setting the groundwork and continuing that path that the industry itself and all of the stakeholders involved, you know, will take it seriously and be working towards improving and continually evolving both our knowledge and the implementation.
Okay, great. Now, given the seemingly increasing demand for items such as raw milk and direct sales of meat, even at roadside stands or farmers' markets, how might good management practices be integrated for these particular products can be integrated into the system?
Let's see. If I understood the question, I think, you know, the expectation for food safety management programs and implementation of preventive controls cuts across, you know, all foods. I just happen to be talking about, you know, produce because that's really the sphere that I work in, but it would apply to, you know, any of those other products, and there are comparable expectations being put in place for them as well.
In Romero's absence here, Trevor, we have another question from the audience. What do you say to a small farmer who refuses to believe in the food safety issues? Is there a way to get them to see the light?
Short answer is no, I don't think so. I think you try and build, you know, a compelling argument for how, you know, these things have to be part of their business plan and their personal liability, and work at that through providing case examples that unfortunately quite often have some very tragic consequences, not just for, of course, the individuals who are ill and impacted in that way and their families, but the industry or commodity group as a whole, the farm workers, the labor, the community that is supported by that agricultural labor. The ripple effect is really staggering. I'm confident that their next speaker will be addressing a lot of that, and one just has to look at the, you know, listeria outbreak on cantaloupe on this past year to just see yet a very, very tragic and dramatic example of what happens. I think ultimately, you know, for somebody that simply believes that denial is their preferred food safety management response, ultimately, I believe the federal agencies will close them down.
Good. One more question here, and then we'll transition over into Marco's presentation. It seems like there's also a consumer education process that might be happening in parallel with the producer education process in terms of how we monitor and manage these things and how the consumer reacts or recovers from these kinds of things. Do you see that easing in the future in terms of the consumer being a little bit more understanding and therefore recovering a little bit faster?
If I understand that, well, maybe I'll do my best to answer it in this way. One, clearly there is a role and a contribution for both food safety awareness and, you know, personal, you know, food safety preventive controls that consumers, you know, should be exercising. The one of the things we always want to point out is that in general, you know, if something like fresh produce is contaminated, there's in most cases almost nothing really that the home consumer can do to, you know, certainly to remove it or completely protect themselves. And so we can't put it on them to be responsible. But there are certainly handling practices that, you know, can contribute to making the likelihood of exceeding their personal dose response level greater. So, yes, there are education programs for consumers already in place and expanding. There are things that, including my lab, is doing to try and at least say, here are some things that you can do to help protect yourself. I don't know that they will get to a greater level of understanding and acceptance of foodborne illness as a way to minimize the, you know, or accelerate the recovery period for an individual commodity, if that was part of the question.
Thank you, Trevor. Excellent information, and we want to remind participants that these presentations are available in the Ag and Uncertain Times website, so if you need to go back and revisit, that's where you can find him. Now it is our pleasure to introduce Dr. Marco Palma, who is an assistant professor and extension economist in the Ag Economics Department with Texas AgriLife Extension Service at Texas A&M University. Dr. Palma's responsibilities involve the statewide leadership and coordination for extension educational programs and applied research in horticultural marketing. He provides technical expertise in educational program development for industry audiences such as producers, packers, shippers, wholesalers, and retail trade. Also, he's involved with individual and team efforts to develop, implement, and evaluate curricula, extension education programs, and applied research-related materials, dealing with the strategic marketing, risk management, and policy trade issues facing horticultural and nursery industry clientele. Today, Dr. Palma is going to tell us about the economics of food safety in the produce industry, and this will build from Trevor's presentation with regards to what impacts these outbreaks have. So, Dr. Palma, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ramiro, and thanks to the organizers for setting up this interesting conference. What I'm going to be doing today is I'm going to start giving a little introduction about the horticulture industry, specifically to edible horticulture, the fruits and vegetable side. And then I'm going to talk about some of the issues from the consumer perspective in terms of the cost of hospitalizations and cost of to the agricultural sector as a result of food safety outbreaks. Then I'm going to talk about some specific measures of how policy can influence the prevention methods that we use for food safety outbreaks and how much do they differ across the size of different growers. And finally, I'm going to give an overview, providing some information, some specific agri information, to try and answer the question, how long does it take to for a consumer to go back to consume the normal levels of consumption being those that were forecasted prior to the food safety outbreak? And are there any changes in consumers' reactions and the time that it takes them to go back to normal levels when the outbreak comes from a source that was identified domestically here in the U.S. versus an outbreak that comes from an imported source? And to do so, I'm going to refer to specific samples of outbreaks that occurred in the last few years. So we have seen an increase in the consumption of horticultural products from 1970 to the year 2000, fruit and vegetable per capita consumption increased 21%. However, if we look at what's happened since 2000 to 2009, most of the traditional fruit and vegetables per capita consumption has remained relatively flat. And we have seen an increase in other specialty or non-traditional fruit and vegetables in the market, partly because consumers are willing to try these newer products, because now they have access to different educational methods, including 24/7 TV station that shows has some cooking demonstrations, and now they're able to know how to prepare some of these products. But even so, when we look at this and what's the role of food safety in the food and vegetable industry, We have, as an industry, had the perception that fruits and vegetables are good for you, and as an industry, we've been using that that as a promotional campaign to try and increase food consumption of fruits and vegetables. Even today, the dietary guidelines and this administration has placed a special emphasis in fruits and vegetable consumptions. And now, as opposed to having the 1992 pyramid, we now have a simpler message, which is My Plate, that was released back in 2010. And essentially, it says that fruits and vegetables are supposed to compose half of what you eat in a day. Now, when we go back to look at the 80s and early 90s, most of the food safety outbreaks were related to processed foods and mainly meats. And we, as an industry, in the produce industry, were not really concerned about those. Well, I think that the game changer was the spinach outbreak of 2006 brought a lot of attention in the consumer's mind. So what I'm going to do today is look at some of those perspectives from the consumer side. Now, according to the CDC, there are more than 76 million people that are affected and over 5,000 die as a result of poisoning every year. These numbers were actually revised and brought down in a more recent study that they conducted. But what a point I want to make here is that for the first time, consumers are in a contradiction point, because in one side we're telling them fruits and vegetables are good for your health. They're good. They're full of vitamins and minerals and other substances that are very good for your health. They're full of compounds and other things that that will increase your health outcomes and also possibly even contribute to your overall lifestyle, healthy in terms of healthy habits. Now, on the other side, we have had many recalls because of food safety outbreaks, and I think that Trevor did a very good job of even providing a list of some of the most common outbreaks that have occurred in the past 10 or 12 years. Now, if you look at this, most of the foodborne illnesses are associated with either Campylobacter, Salmonella, or E. coli, are the most common source of food safety outbreaks. There was a study that estimated that the total health cost of food safety outbreaks is about $152 billion in the United States. That includes physician services, hospital services, medicines, and reduction in quality of life of people. That includes deaths, pain and suffering, and disabilities. Now, I have to emphasize here that this cost is purely from the health cost estimation. It does not include any losses to the agricultural sector, which is the primary charge that I have today to talk to you about. But from these $152 billion, about $40 billion of those are attributed to food safety outbreaks that come from the produce industry. So it's a very large percentage in terms of the healthcare cost. Now, what about the cost to agriculture? And what we've seen is that the consumer reaction to a food safety outbreak depends on several issues. But there is an immediate reduction in consumption of the product that is affected by a food safety outbreak. And what we found when we dug these consumer studies is that consumers have very small recall or where the product is coming from. And because we have a lot of different fruits and vegetables, they are very high substitutes for each other. When they heard some negative news about a specific crop, for example, if they heard there was a food safety outbreak in cantaloupes, there is a very low recall of where that problem was coming from. And it's very easy for consumers to switch the consumption of cantaloupes to something else, like watermelons and any other fruit. So the response of consumers is related to the source. Where is that product coming from? But the immediate reaction is to shut down consumption. And if there is a recall, of course, we have a shutdown in the movement of those products. Now, how bad is that reduction going to be depends on several things. Some of them I've highlighted here are the number of people that is affected because of the outbreak. The second one is the number of deaths. The regional scope, is the problem concentrated in a specific region, or is it national in scope? The type of product that we're talking about in terms of the products industry, as I mentioned before, because there is a very high substitutability effect in consumers, they tend to substitute those relatively easy. And the origin, and of course, the length of the outbreak. So, specifically, even so, after the contemporaneous effect of people reducing that, there are usually some other longer-term impacts in consumption. And some industries, it takes several months, several weeks to several months, even years, to recover and go back to what we refer to as normal levels, or those levels that were forecasted prior to any food safety outbreak. But there are some cases where an industry never fully recovered, depending on what product we talk about. But there are some liability issues that the entire supply chain may face. And, of course, there are also longer-term impacts, and those, as I mentioned before, might last more than a few days. So what we wanted to ask the question is, do consumers really care when an outbreak occurred from a source within the U.S., and do they respond differently if the source was an imported product that was imported? And in order to answer this question, it's because we want to find out what's really driving consumers' reduction. And what we found, the message that we want to convey today, is that regardless of where the source of the problem is, the industries are affected. Regardless of whether the product was domestically or imported, both sides of the industry are affected. And this is what I want to show today here is we have selected these three case studies. One was the spinach outbreak, and we selected that because that was a purely domestic source. And the second one is a cantaloupe outbreak in March of 2008. That outbreak was linked to a single farm in Honduras, Central America. So the second case study was something that was that had an imported source. And then the third one is kind of like a mix because it was first attributed to tomatoes coming from Florida, but then it was found that it was jalapeno and serrano peppers that came from Mexico. So we did our analysis, and what we the methodology we used was something similar to what economists do in financial markets when there is a crash in stocks, because there is an immediate reduction of shipments of those products. Then we wanted to answer the question, what happens in the neighborhood of the dates just a few days prior to the outbreak, and what happens right after the outbreaks, a few weeks after the outbreaks? How does information about the price and the quantity, domestic quantity and the imported quantity changes, and how are those information effects transferred back to the consumer? And what we found is that for the case of spinach, that was the first domestic source, we found that there was a farm-level loss in spinach equivalent to about $12 million. Now, this is just at the farm level. If we look at the retail level, we found that it was probably over $63 million. And even some industries, when the spinach outbreak occurred, there were some spinach still in the fields in Texas. And we have to remember that this outbreak was linked to a source in California. And the Texas industry suffered a few million dollars in losses, even though they weren't even harvesting some of that spinach. The second outbreak was the cantaloupe outbreak that was salmonella. It was linked to a single firm in Honduras. Cantaloupe is a very interesting crop because at the time when this happened, we didn't really have a lot of domestic production. Most of the cantaloupes in the market were imported cantaloupes because of seasonality issues. But some of the early cantaloupe varieties were starting to come out. And what we found is that there was an estimated $5.8 million in losses in the U.S., even though we really didn't have a lot of products in the U.S. So because of, as a result of the outbreak, in the weeks following the outbreak, when the U.S. domestic production came, there was still a reduction in at the farm level in the U.S. because consumers had a very difficult time recalling, or they didn't have a very good recall of where the products were coming from, and they didn't remember if the source was Honduras or something else imported, or a product that was coming from California, so they simply substituted cantaloupe consumption for something else. At the retail level, those losses were estimated to be about $20.7 million, and the farm level import losses were estimated at about $23 million, with almost all of those going to the Honduras, cantaloupe imports. Now, when we look at this, what we found interestingly was that people went back to consume cantaloupes faster than they were for some other food safety outbreaks that came from a domestic source. Now, we wanted to understand why, and we hypothesized that maybe the reason is because they perceive that we're doing a very good job of protecting the borders and not allowing those contaminated products to come into the U.S. But even so, the third case study that we looked at was a mixed source, because it was first attributed to tomatoes in both the U.S. and Mexico, but then it was found that it was actually peppers with a Mexican source. So for the tomato industry, we had farm-level losses in the U.S. As a result of the negative news and the initial FDA alert on tomatoes of about $25 million. And retail losses represent about $90 million. And those products were substituted with imports coming from Canada. And then, so the story that we see here is that regardless of where the source of the product is coming from, whether it's imported or produced domestically, consumers have a very low recall of where the product is coming from. So as an industry, we're all together in this, trying to handle some of these food safety outbreaks from the economics standpoint. So if we look at some of the compliance costs for good agricultural practices, and what we did is we looked at certain activities that were pre-Food Safety Modernization Act, and we cataloged those activities into different things. In California, we had a partner where we collected information about the leafy green marketing agreement and what was the annual cost of compliance. And, of course, prior to 2006, where there were not very defined activities, the costs were about $210,000, and that almost tripled after the spinach outbreak to about $600,000. This was a survey conducted back in 2010. And so when you look at the compliance cost and try to find out what's the main driver of that compliance cost, and the main thing is third-party audits. The second is that more people, more staff dedicated to food safety issues exclusively, and then some other things related to water testing. So as you look at the list of most of these things that require compliance costs, they're mostly fixed cost, which means that when you translate that in a per unit basis, those costs will be less in a per unit basis for a larger grower to a smaller grower. So then we have the full question about the tester's amendment for those facilities with $500,000 or less in production, and also direct marketed products. And I think that this brings a very interesting question. And the meat industry went through this back in the late 80s and early 90s when the smaller processing houses had to comply with the law, but there were even a few years for the transition period. Now, whether that's the question here with the Food Safety Modernization Act, I'm not really sure that that's the case. But what are the alternatives that producers have to comply with some of the food safety outbreaks? Where there are three types, individual initiatives, cooperative initiatives, and public sector support, just like the FSMA is a good example of that. But essentially, some of the individual initiatives include producers really taking it upon themselves to comply or not with set of standards. Now, the first question here is that when we talk about food safety, there are not universal set of standards. We have some standards in the U.S. that we used to, but when we look at horticulture, it's really a global business in nature, and we do not have a common set of standards for products that are coming from overseas. If we look at the share of consumption of fruits and vegetables that comes from imported sources, over 40% of fruits consumed in the U.S. are imported. Now, some of those fruits are really not something that we produce in the U.S., so if we take out, for example, bananas, we're still consuming over 30% of the sharing consumption comes from overseas. So this brings another dimension in terms of trade and common set of standards. I mentioned also the fact that individual initiatives have different consequences in terms of the per unit cost because of the structure of the cost of compliance for most of the activities related to good agricultural practices. And also, the one thing also that we need to consider is that those niche markets, such as farmers markets and other ag marketing and smaller businesses, would not have to comply with the new Food Safety Modernization Act. So are they going to do any sort of activity? That's the question that we'll face policy-wise in the next 4 or 5 years. But there has to be some sort of assurance that the product is safe. Now, I do recognize there is not such thing as a 100% safe product, but it's related back to quality, and safety is one thing that consumers have accustomed to demand as part of what they consume, not only in the fruit and vegetable side, but in many other products. Some of the cooperative initiatives, I think that the California leafy green producers is a very good example of these, and there is the potential, and there's some talks now to try to come with a very similar initiative at the national level. And I know there are some people from the industry in California and Florida and here in Texas that are talking about some opportunities for collaboration to try and implement some similar system on a national basis. Now, in terms of the international dimension, probably the best known guidelines are set by Global GAP, which is essentially a certification program that consumers have to go through, and they also have to check certain compliance things. And once they get that certification, there are some markets like the European market, they have to have a Global GAP certification in order to export those products to the European Union. And the public sector support refers to the government role. So the Food Safety Modernization Act is really the key player in this area. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about that because I think Trevor did a good job of looking at some of the issues related to the Food Safety Modernization Act. But in general, it's the role of the government in working to harmonize some of these standards, and also what role do we play as extension educators in terms of delivering some of the good agricultural practices. Now, some of these standards, I think, that have to be very commodity-specific, and in the last 5 or 6 years, I think that the industry has done, industry and also with some support with the public sector and land-grant universities across the U.S. have done a good job of trying to come up with different set of standards that are specific to certain commodities, and not only that, but also that are based on scientific evidence. Now, there's still some work that needs to be done with third-party audit procedures. Some of the things that are going on right now is trying to consolidate third-party audits. So if somebody's coming to do an audit in South Texas, for example, they can do that for several growers, and in that way try to reduce the cost of the audit process. So with that, I think that the message that we want to convey here is that regardless of where the food safety offerings occur, that consumers view those products as something that is harmful, and they have a very low recall or where the product is really coming from. And we're together in this issue in terms of that, and we've shown that through a few research projects, and that we really need to work on an emphasis on the prevention. And prevention means different type of agricultural practices that the producers can take, but there are some costs associated with that. And most of those costs are fixed, and that so in a way, that's why policy-wise, it's understandable why the government tries to level the field in some way to try to provide some room for smaller growers and direct marketing growers to comply with this. But I think that food safety is the problem of everybody, and that we'll need to find a mechanism where everybody's held accountable for the quality and the safety of the products. So with that, I'm going to see if there are any questions from the audience.
Yeah, thank you, Marco. That was very interesting and informative. We do have some questions, and given the increased scrutiny on produce and the compliance cost that you discussed, can this be considered, would all these increase in good management practices and good agricultural practices, could it be looked at as giving a competitive advantage to U.S. producers, or in this case, does the cost exceed the benefits of that?
That's a very good question from the consumer's perspective, and I think that there are two parts to that answer. And when we first started addressing the issues of food safety, I think that the original approach we had was, well, California very quickly came out with a very comprehensive plan of handling food safety issues, especially for the leafy green side. Now we have to recall that more than 90% of the leafy greens consumed in the U.S. come from California. But I think that Florida followed after. I'm talking about post the 2006 spinach outbreak. So there were a lot of confusion in the consumer's mind in terms of what does it mean when a product is it complies with the good agricultural practices set forth in Florida versus a product that is compliant with some other set of good agricultural practices certification process for California or some other states. So originally there was a little bit of a problem understanding that from the consumer side, but now I think that consumers are understanding that food safety is a problem that the agricultural sector, especially the produce industry, is trying to address. And we don't really have a lot of good information about other good agricultural practices outside of what we have from industry-driven perspectives. But I think that they consider these to be sort of like a differentiation factor. And the question is, are they willing to pay any premiums? Or is the fact that they're buying the product in itself and keeping that market share for those products enough information for us to know that, well, they're selecting that based on those issues and what's the role of food safety plays there. And I'm in the process of conducting some experimental auctions to answer the question, is there more credibility to a government-issued food safety compliance label that highlights some good agricultural practices versus an industry-driven initiative like the California Leafy Green Marketing Agreement. And I'm analyzing whether there are some important differences in willingness to pay, if any, associated with those from the consumer's perspective.
Thank you. I see that Trevor is still online. Trevor, are you still here?
Yeah, I'm here for just a little bit longer.
Okay, we'll ask a question that may be directed to both of you then. Given the recent outbreaks of such as what occurred with cantaloupes in Colorado, how did the industry respond to better address? How can the industry respond to better address those safety food safety issues? And was the response adequate, or what else could be happening?
So very very quickly, there was a variety of responses due to both the recognition as the FDA investigation. Details came out as the specific events that appear to have contributed to the listeriosis outbreak became more broadly known, and that response really, I would say, is still in its fullest extent being developed. But a number of things happened from pulling together the industry, regulators, and extension and academics with some experience in this area to really reassess and evaluate both the specific food safety management practices, the need and recognition for enhanced commodity-specific guidance in the future, as well as a real key need in broader education and support for growers to get out information related to food safety management practices and the science of risk assessment and hazard analysis that already exists for that particular commodity, so that implementation is applied in a more uniform way. So they basically, as Marco discussed, taken a bit of the model, at least for California, of the LGMA, working towards a similar marketing order for cantaloupes that would include both California and Arizona, enhancing the details of those documents and audit protocols, and going through that process, as well as stepping up and supporting some key targeted research. So that it's still going on, it's still being developed, but a number of very rapid responses were taken to improve the coverage of gaps for the whole melon industry.
Thank you. And while we answer, while we ask the final question or two, can you please respond to the questions that appear on your screen and give us some feedback about the today's session and also about the conference if you happen to join any other, any of the sessions that, that were presented earlier. Marco, do you have anything to add to Trevor's response?
No, I think that he's right in that sense, and most of these initiatives have been very well received by industry leaders, and they're working in cooperation with several different states. So I think that's an interesting way of interacting with different people with different necessities.
Okay, thank you. I have a quick question I'm not clear about. Producers in the U.S., if they sell less than 500,000, are exempted from compliance, good agricultural practices. But does that exemption, how are foreign producers, producers based out of the U.S. that are exporting less than $500,000?
Well, that's a good question. And you know, if you
well, don't forget there's a distance issue as part of that. It's not just the sales, gross sales.
There is a limit
okay,
of what's
thanks.
Local, but also it says 500. The bill actually says $500,000 facilities. We're not really. I'm not really sure if that means producers or if it means processors. But most people who sell products from overseas that we import are working with somebody who's already. Probably already requiring some sort of good agricultural practice certification process. At least that's the experience for most fruits and vegetables being imported from Texas. So I will say that the largest majority of those come with some sort of a good agricultural practices management. Not necessarily, maybe not necessarily all of the requirements in terms of traceability and all the documentation required, but they do already come with some of that.
Maybe, Romero, if I could just very quickly add, you know, that of course is exemption from regulation under an FDA rule, not exemption necessarily from implementing some type of GAPS or food safety plan. And what I certainly have seen in California and across the U.S., you know, where I've had those contacts, is that retailers are increasing and elevating the expectations within their local grown approved supplier base. So it's translating into movement to elevate more uniform and broad implementation of programs across the board, whether you're, you know, in that exempt category for FDA or not.
Okay, thanks. And one final question. What liability issues from product contamination should producers be aware of? And, from a risk management perspective, are there ways to mitigate these liabilities other than GAPS, than using GAPS?
I'll start the answer, and then hopefully Marco can add and embellish. But strictly speaking, that's a bad pun. There's strict liability, concerns. If there's contamination or if, you know, product, you know, is shown to cause harm, you're strictly liable. And it doesn't matter, you know, sort of what happened. That's one level. And again, that's what the preventive control programs are trying to address, is to minimize the likelihood that could occur. Having those programs in place, I think, protects an individual business from any sort of criminal liability or negligence. And, of course, that, I think, is completely within your control.
Okay, thank you, Trevor. Marco, anything to add?
No, I think that rounds it up.
Okay, well, thank you both, Trevor and Marco, for two excellent presentations and a lot of good information. I think this is a topic that will take even more importance as we move into the future. The slide on your screens gives you a summary of today's sessions, and we invite you to revisit some of these in our website, the Ag in Uncertain Times website, and use the information for your educational programming as you please. Again, Ag in Uncertain Times website has recordings of the webinars, the presenter's slide set, listing of all the speakers and contact information, and also a discussion of other webinar topics that we've covered in the past. If you have any area or topic of today's webinars or past webinars that you'd like to see addressed in the future, please let us know, and you can do that by using the Q&A chat pod on the left of your screen or by sending us an email at the email address that appears on your screen. That is westrme@wsu.edu, and we'll appreciate any feedback that you can help us, that you can provide to help us plan future educational activities. We also have a file share file. This file is a PDF file that includes links to all the websites and links that were used in today's programs. We encourage you to download it, and then you can access all the files directly from your computer by from that file, that you can download it into your own computer. That is all we have for today. We thank you, and we hope you really enjoyed the presentations and that you found all the programs today and our web conference, the speed of change, as informative as we wanted it to be. Thank you, and you have a great day.